This Frontenas podcast is brought to you by TechPont, a San Antonio company that uses cutting-edge digital technology to elevate marketing and advertising campaigns while reporting on transparent, measurable results. Their custom-built marketing strategies offer complete digital solutions and management. TechPont strives to help businesses connect with customers and effectively grow businesses. More at TechPonte.com.
I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. This is Fronteras, a program about issues along the U.S.-Mexico border and changing demographics in the Southwest.
The Chinese or the Koreans start blowing horns. My knees just like clapping hands. You could hear them. And not only mine. As soon as we try to get off, we start losing guys. Start killing.
That's Korean War veteran Eliseo Kramer. His story was told in 2016 to the Voces Oral History Project at the University of Texas at Austin. Voces is the leading Latino oral history archive in the U.S. It's collected the untold stories of Latinos and Latinas who served in the two world wars, Korea, Vietnam, and in the battles for Latino civil rights. Maggie Rivas Rodriguez, a professor of journalism at UT, started the project in 1999. She says the origins of the project began in 1992 when she was a reporter for the Dallas Morning News. She interviewed the founder of MALDEF, Pete Tijerina, for an article on a lawsuit involving South Texas border communities. She discovered he was a World War II veteran. He told her all civil rights war horses were World War II veterans. That spurred her to follow the thread.
Everybody that I interviewed who had been Mexican Americans of the World War II generation had come back from the war or had after the war. They had really dismantled some of the barriers to full integration into our society, but I couldn't find any books about them. So I would interview college professors. They'd say, well, there really hasn't been much research about that because there's so few of us doing the research, and I knew about oral history. So I met with some journalist friends of mine in 1993 at the National Association of Hispanic Journalists Conference, and we talked about the idea, we put together a proposal, and then it didn't go anywhere. Well, flash forward, you know, I got married, had children, went to North Carolina for graduate school, came back to UT Austin to teach full-time, and I was allowed a class that I could teach any way that I wanted as long as it had a newspaper attached to it. And I said, can I do my oral history class, which I'd been kind of fantasizing about? And they said, sure. So I started looking at Mexican Americans and World War II and post-war civil rights. My students would do interviews mostly in Austin and in San Antonio, and the stories that we were finding were just amazing. People who had gone through the Great Depression, many of them had lost a parent or even two parents in childhood, and the men ended up going to the military, some of the women as well, and they had a different sense of themselves after World War II. And that different sense of themselves empowered them to demand better treatment for themselves and for their families. And I say this all the time, Norma, had it not been for the efforts of that generation of men and women, people like me would never have enjoyed the opportunities that we've enjoyed. Because these were not just opportunities that were handed to us. These were opportunities that somebody had to crack open a door, sometimes very gently, sometimes they had to kick in the door. And so I'm eternally grateful to that generation of men and women.
So how many Mexican Americans did fight in World War II?
So a few years ago, I teamed up with a demographer, a sociologist. He got a bunch of different databases, census numbers, some military statistics, and he did the best he could and came up with a number that is between 450,000 to 750,000. But it could be much more than that. And the reason I say it is this. There was no consistent method to count Latinos. And our project has always focused not only on the Mexican-American experience, but in the broader Latino experience, including Puerto Ricans, Cuban-Americans, and anybody else who is kind of under the Latino, Hispanic too as well, because we have some Spanish-Americans in our project as well. So there was no consistent way of counting them. So we have, for instance, in San Saba, Texas, the Botello family. They had five brothers who served in the military during World War II. Of those five, three of them were categorized as white and two of them as Mexican on their discharge papers. I can tell you this with every certainty because we have copies of their discharge papers. And we have copies of other people's discharge papers. And so we know that the military really just did not know how to handle Mexican Americans in particular, but Latinos in general. We're really more than a race. We're really an ethnicity. And so, for instance, we have Afro-Cubans. And so somebody with a name like Grillo could be counted as white. He could be counted as Cuban, but he was Afro-Cuban. And so, you know, it's one of those things that we're really not sure about the numbers. But to me, it makes it more fascinating at how people dealt with the whole issue of race.
And so from there, you ended up with what is really just a fraction of all the stories that could be told from the veterans of World War II who are dying at unprecedented numbers every day. It's almost hard for me to imagine that there's going to be a time when there will be no more World War II veterans left in our lifetimes, which is saddening to me because my father was also a World War II veteran like yours was. But your project expanded beyond World War II. It included the Korean conflict, the Vietnam conflict, as you were mentioning, the struggle for Latino civil rights. And did you ever imagine when you started this 20 years ago that it would expand to such an extent? Because I can't imagine that you're just limiting yourselves to certain categories. I'm sure that every time you hear a story, another one unfolds.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I would love to say I had the foresight to think about this, but I was, when we first started looking just at World War II, we knew from the very beginning that we had touched a nerve and that it was a really very, very rich area to gather interviews. So I was really just focused on the World War II part of it. But even from the very beginning, we had World War II veterans who were veterans of three wars, World War II, Korea, and Vietnam. So even at the beginning, Vietnam was already kind of in the background. And the other thing that was happening ever since the beginning was we would be doing interviews about World War II, and people would come up and they would ask, when are you going to do Vietnam? And, you know, frankly, my hands were full with World War II because it wasn't just that we were doing the interview. We were creating something from scratch. We were trying to put together not just the recording part of it, but how we would present it, how we would preserve it. Because it's not just that you make the tape and you put it on a shelf. You have to worry about long-time preservation. And so we've been very fortunate here at UT Austin that we have a great library that partnered with us from the beginning. And so they've been doing the digitization, which is more involved than just making a DVD. It's much more involved and requires some special skills. So we were trying to work through all of these, and we were really in survival mode for a long time until we kind of, okay, we have our methods in place. But the whole thing about the Vietnam generation kept on coming up and kept on coming up because it affected the World War II generation as well, because for the most part, those were their children. So I kept on saying, well, when we get enough money, we'll start doing Vietnam. And then in 2009, we got a major grant, a major federal grant, and then we did expand to the Vietnam generation, Korea and Vietnam generation, as specific areas of collection. So it also allowed us to do a lot of traveling. We had done some traveling before that, but it was not something that we could really concentrate on. But with that much money, we were able to hire a lot of part-time staff, and we traveled all over the country and did interviews in the Midwest and in Florida and throughout Texas. So we were really, really fortunate to be able to do that.
We're talking with Maggie Rivas Rodriguez, professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and founder of the Voces Oral History Project at UT. When we come back,
people often will say to us, I didn't do anything important. I was only peeling potatoes, or I was only, you know, a grunt, and I wasn't an officer or anything like that.
Maggie Rivas Rodriguez says every story is important. More of our conversation is coming up next on Fronteras. Welcome back to Fronteras. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio.
I attended schools in San Felipe, which was a school district formed after Mexicanos seceded from the Anglo school district because of the unequal treatment they had there. So that's kind of where my DNA starts.
That's the voice of Blandina Bambi Cárdenas Flores, the former president of the University of Texas Pan-American in Edinburgh. She was the first Latina to be named president of a University of Texas institution. Cárdenas Flores' story was collected in 2017 by the Voces Oral History Project at UT Austin. When Voces founder Maggie Rivas Rodriguez was formulating the project, she drew upon several sources, including the Shoah Foundation's interviews with Holocaust survivors.
They had this tremendous pre-interview form, which was really long and lengthy. And I said, oh my God, this is fascinating. And I said, can we use this? And they said, oh yeah, sure, go right ahead. So we credit the Shoah Foundation for that because it really has been helpful to us. So we've now adapted it to our own needs, and it's about 25 pages long. And it has details about the person that we've interviewed, their own background, their parents, their families, the names of their schools, their children's names. So however much they're willing to share with us. Some people say that's way too personal. I don't want to do this. So we leave that up to them. We don't force anybody to do anything they're not comfortable doing. But we do try to start off with that pre-interview form because that pre-interview form makes it a lot easier for us to make sure that we get consistent details about everybody that we interview. As far as finding people to interview, it really depends on what the topic is. We started doing interviews with Vietnam vets, and one thing that kept on coming up was different areas of political and civic engagement. And that came from the very first World War II interviews that we did, by the way. There was always that civil rights thread that was woven through a lot of these interviews that was so crucial to us and really important for just telling the Latino story. So we started looking at different pockets and we expanded and created a political and civic engagement collection. And that part has really opened up a whole universe of different topics and topics for research. You know, we've published 5 books on Latinos in World War II. When we started, there were no books about Latinos in World War II. There's now several, but of those several, 5 of them are from our project. We're going to be doing the same thing with the different war periods, but beyond that, there's a whole universe of material that hasn't been excavated. So what we try to look at is kind of like that larger picture of whatever the topic is that we're looking at. You know, when I read history, I love history. When I read it, I love hearing not just the stories about the generals who were on the front lines, but also the people, you know, the foot soldiers, the people who were in the background having to do supplies, making sure that the soldiers of the front lines had the supplies, and even the people that were back home overseas making the parachutes and building the planes and building the tanks. To me, that makes a really full picture of how one issue, one event, affects so many different and touches so many different lives than just the people that were the principals involved.
So did you ever find when you were interviewing subjects that they would reveal things to you that they never revealed to your family? For example, you know, when my father was alive, we never really talked to him about the war. He served in World War II and he also served in Korea. But whenever he would bring it up in conversation, it always had to do with either the food he was eating or where he was in Europe and the food he was eating in Europe. It almost always centered around food, but he never really shared too much about his experiences overseas. And I'm wondering if you encountered anything similar to that, where they were revealing things to you that, because maybe of the formality of the situation, it sort of encouraged them to reveal more than what was expected.
You know, that's a great point. And I think that you've hit on something that we run into all the time. One thing that happens is that people often will say to us, I didn't do anything important. I was only peeling potatoes, or I was only, you know, a grunt, and I wasn't an officer or anything like that. And what we try to make very clear to people is everybody's role is important. The generals couldn't do their jobs without the infantrymen. All of these people have an important, crucial role to play in any given situation. So every role is important. If you take that one piece out, the whole thing would fall apart. And so we try to really, really make sure that we let people know that we value whatever level of involvement they had was an important involvement for us to understand. There was no such thing as an unimportant role in any one of these endeavors. So that's something that we always tell people. And yes, they oftentimes will tell us in the middle of an interview, I've never said that, not even to my wife. So I think that you're right. I think it is the formality of the interview process. But I also think the other part of it is, it's very simple, is I'm going to give you an example with my own father. And I use this example all the time, but it always amuses me. So my father was stationed in the Aleutian Islands during World War II in a place called Dutch Harbor. So in 1992, I said to my dad, hey, Daddy, let's take a trip together. Where would you like to go? He says, let's go to Dutch Harbor. I want to retrace my steps. I said, fine. So he and I flew to Dutch Harbor. I had no idea what I was getting myself into. I was expecting, you know, nice hotels and stuff. No, it's like a fishing kind of place. There were two really, really expensive hotels. And then the other places were these lodges where the men that worked on the huge fishing vessels would live, just with bunk beds and community bathrooms and stuff. And I did not know that I was getting myself into that, but that's what we did. So we went to Dutch Harbor. We retrace all of his steps. He's, you know, telling me these wonderful memories of how he was there. So this is 1992. 1999, I sit in his living room in San Antonio. I'm asking him all these questions. And so he's telling me, and he's talking about seeing the Japanese Zeros, the airplanes, strafing the island. And he gives me these really vivid details about it. And afterwards, I said, it turned off the camera, and I said, Daddy, I don't understand. You and I went to Dutch Harbor in 1992, and you never told me you saw the Japanese Zeros strafing the island. And he looks at me and says, Mija, you never asked. And he was right. And that's why I do think that oral history interviews are so crucial. It's not just sitting in front of a recording device, but it's really that interaction with someone where they are asking you explicit questions, and they're responding to what you're saying and asking follow-up questions. That's where the real beauty of it is.
The Oral History Project doesn't necessarily focus on war veterans or civil rights, but there's actually an event coming up, and I thought it was really interesting because I'd never heard of this particular program. There's a tribute that's coming up later this month, a program called Garras Colendas.
Have you ever been to Garras Colendas? Garras Colendas, Garras Colendas.
Aired on PBS. It was one of the very first national bilingual TV children's shows. And this brought to mind to me actually just today when I was doing some background research on this program of a show that I did used to watch, which was called Villa Alegre. And I thought, oh my God, I did not realize I was being exposed to this stuff when I was a kid. And I must have completely missed Garras Colendas. But can you tell us a little bit more about this upcoming event and the Voces involvement in it?
Yeah. So Aida Barrera was the creator of Garras Colendas. There was, you know, it was a bilingual children's television program on PBS. And my interest in her was because in November, we did something called Voices of Documentary Film. So we did this event where we brought in documentary filmmakers to talk about the issues and then some of the solutions. Well, she's one of the people that lives here in Austin and has, you know, did Garras Colendas. But after she did Garras Colendas, she did two documentary series for PBS. One was called Checking It Out, and another one was called Somebody Else's Place. and checking it out, it was investigative reporters going and doing some pretty serious reporting. Somebody Else's Place was kind of like reality television way ahead of its time, where you'd have teenagers of different ethnicities going to each other's homes and staying there and then kind of understanding a different way of life. So I went to meet her for the first time, and almost the first thing she said was, "I want you to have my tapes." I jumped out of my skin and said, "Absolutely." And then I started, you know, we started realizing how important and pivotal Caras Colendas was in all sorts of arenas, including bilingual children's education. She was really on the forefront of this because even before she did Caras Colendas, she did public programming on KLRU and KLRN. And she had kind of fallen off the radar for a lot of us. And we really wanted to celebrate her amazing contributions. So we paired up with KLRU, the local PBS station, and we're going to do a nice tribute to her on Thursday, May the 23rd. And I'll tell you, I had no idea how popular it was going to be because within a few weeks, the place was at capacity. So unfortunately, we will record it and we'll put it up online, but we don't have space anymore for any more folks to attend, unfortunately, because she touched so many lives. This program really touched a lot of lives.
We've been talking with Maggie Rivas Rodriguez, a professor of journalism at the University of Texas at Austin and founder of the Voces Oral History Project. The sold-out tribute to Aida Barrera and her groundbreaking bilingual children's show, Caras Colendas, is Thursday, May 23rd at the Emma S. Barrientos Mexican-American Cultural Center in Austin. To hear more of my interview with Rivas Rodriguez, including how she finds her subjects and what's next for the project, go to tpr.org. Thanks for joining us this week on Fronteras. You can find the show under the Programs tab on our website, tpr.org, and wherever you get your podcasts. Fronteras is produced by Norma Martinez and Lauren Terrazas. Our executive producer is Dan Katz, and our editor is Fernando Ortiz Jr. Charanga Cakewalk composed our theme music. I'm Norma Martinez with Texas Public Radio in San Antonio. Thank you.